Even if you don't speak Farsi, you can probably catch one word, dictator, as in Makbar Dictator, death to the dictator. That was recorded yesterday at a protest near the Iranian capital, Tehran. There have been similar protests for weeks now across Iran. They began after a 22-year-old woman by the name of Mahsa Amini was arrested by the country's morality police because of her clothing. A few hours later, she was in a coma. 3 days later, she was dead. The regime tried to cover it up, claiming she had suffered a heart attack. Her family says she was beaten to death. Soon enough, women took to the streets across the country. The security forces have responded with brutal force. Thousands have been arrested. More than 100 have been killed, according to human rights groups. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is On Point. This hour, the biggest unrest Iran has seen in years. Does it threaten the regime? Joining me to talk about that is Dr. Hele Esfandiari. She's Director Emerita of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She was a journalist in Iran until she fled with her husband and daughter in 1979. Thank you for joining us, Hele.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is writer Roya Hakakian. She was also born in Iran and left with her family as a teenager in 1985. Her latest book is A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. Roya, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
So I will start with you, Roya. Why has Mahsa's story spurred such sharp uprisings in Iran?
Because it's everybody's story. There's not a single woman in Iran who has walked out of her home with her hijab on, however she put it on, whether it was strictly, you know, abided by the Islamic dress code rules or not. We have all been stopped in our lives or been warned. And so perhaps what's really most significant about Mahsa is that she's every woman. She's every Iranian woman who has ever walked on the street. And, you know, her parents have said over and over again that she was not even political. She wasn't even interested in politics. And in fact, a piece of misreporting in pretty much all of the media is that she had her headscarf on the day that she was stopped. She was stopped not because of her headscarf, but because of a pair of tight pants, which is, in other words, to say that they will find something wrong with the way you're appearing in order to make a lesson out of you for everyone else out there.
And Hale, can you convey the sense of frustration that has built up among women in Iran about this type of scrutiny?
Let me take you a little back to to pre-revolutionary Iran. In the marches that were in 1979, men and women took part, and women were hoping that their rights would be expanded, not contracted. So over the years, it didn't take long, but over the years, women who lived in the Islamic Republic felt as a second-class citizen. And it didn't matter what kind of class you came for, whether you were religious or not. I mean, some very fundamental rights were denied to you. For example, the way you want to dress when you want to leave the house, or in the case of the personal status law. I mean, women were denied from going and seeking a divorce. Child custody was automatically given to the father. The age of marriage was reduced from 18 to 9. At first, university classes, they tried to segregate women, you know, and university classes they couldn't do it. They segregated schools, elementary and high school. So over the years, all these unhappiness and delegating women to second-class citizens had piled up. And every time there was a demonstration in Iran, women were participating. But this time they decided they should take the lead in this demonstration.
Yes. And Roya, I want you to talk a little bit more about that. We will dive a little bit more into what was happening in 1979 a little bit later. But what is it about these protests, Roya, that's so different than what you've seen in the past?
That's an excellent question. And I think it deserves to be asked over and over again, because these sets of demonstrations are very different from the ones we've seen over the years. And a friend of mine who lives in Tehran left a message for me last night saying that, confirming exactly that sentiment, that for the first time, it's no longer one particular class, one particular interest group, one particular gender, one particular ethnicity that's coming out to the streets. It's not a demand for salary raises or economic difficulties. It's everybody, every group, every social group, every class, every gender, every ethnicity, from throughout Iran in big and small cities who have poured into the streets. And there is a unifying slogan, woman, life, liberty. And that's really the distinct feature of this round of demonstrations as opposed to previous ones. You know, a few months ago, or perhaps a year ago, you had water demonstrations in southern Iran because of water shortage. 3 years ago, there was an economic uprising against rising prices and the slashing of subsidies. So they were mostly tied into economic difficulties. This time around, this revolution has engaged all people from all walks of life, and they all are centered, or their voices are centered around a single slogan, which, you know, woman, life, liberty. And that's really the significance of this one.
And Roya, I just want to follow up on that, because in recent days, particularly here in the United States, I've seen coverage that is hinting that, oh, this uprising is about so much more than women speaking up for their rights. It is about the economy. It's about these other factors. But you're saying that this is very specifically something different, that it's specifically about women.
Well, of course, you know, there are economic issues that are underlying these demonstrations. There are all sorts of issues. In fact, perhaps the best, most telling example of what this is all about is a song that Shervin Hajizadeh, an Iranian singer, composed of all the demands that the Iranian people have had over the years that the regime has never been able to address. And it's a song about basically the desire for an ordinary life, the desire to be able to be on the street, kiss without being afraid, the desire about, you know, dressing as you wish on the street and not fearing that you may be stopped, the desire to be able to go to the university and not be afraid of being booted out because of, you know, something you say to your professor that may offend some religious, belief or not. And you know, he basically composed a song, which is a compilation of all the things that make up an ordinary peaceful life that Iranians don't have. But what has motivated the engine of all these dreams, of all these demands, has been the women, and it has been focused on women's desire to be free of the veil because it is the most symbolic manifestation of the regime. And then, you know, and then what unifies all these smaller dreams is the notion of a fundamental liberty that all people from all walks of life are lacking in Iran.
And Hele, we're going to talk a little bit more about the previous protests in the 70s in the next segment. But right now, do you see support for these protests outside of Iran? I mean, there were some supportive protests happening in the United States and elsewhere. Do you think the West is behind and supportive of these protests in the way that they were in the past?
Sure. I think although this was a very indigenous protest and started by Iranian women, they demanded that the outside world, especially the West, should support them. And also the Iranian diaspora. In the past, they were not so much eager for the Iranian diaspora to get involved. But this time it's quite different. And interestingly enough, the Supreme Leader today broke his silence after 2 weeks and blamed Israel and the United States for the protest movement, which is, I think, absurd. I mean, this is a protest that started from Iran, and it has gained the support of the rest of the world, all the way from 54 countries in the United Nations to other countries where people came out into the street. In Toronto alone, I believe the day before yesterday, there was a figure like 50,000 people were marching in solidarity, and they welcome it. Inside Iran, I mean, the protesters do welcome this solidarity.
Hele, I'm going to pause you there. Hele Esfandiari and Roya Hakakian are with us. When we come back, women rise up in Iran in 1979. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. We're talking this hour about the protests sparked by Mahsa Amini's death in Iran and the women fighting back and their history of fighting back. It was on March 6, 1979, less than a month after he took power, that the Ayatollah Khomeini announced that women would have to start wearing the chador, a long veil and cloak. 2 days later, on International Women's Day, the women of Iran took to the streets, as the NBC Nightly News report that evening stated.
Despite a heavy snowfall, several thousand women joined different rallies at Tehran University to demand equal rights. They marched around the university, chanting, "At the dawn of freedom, freedom is missing." And they chanted, "Down with Khomeini."
My guests this hour are two women who lived through those times and have been thinking and writing about the place of women in Iran ever since. Dr. Hele Esfandiari is Director Emerita of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. She's a journalist in Iran. She was a journalist in Iran until she fled Iran with her husband and daughter in 1979. And the writer Roya Hakakian also joins us. She was also born in Iran and left with her family as a teenager in 1985. Her latest book is A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. Hale, I want to talk to you first. What are your memories of those 1979 uprisings?
Eileen, I left Iran a couple of months before the revolution, but I followed it very close and talked to a lot of women afterward and wrote about it. I mean, there was a euphoria among the people, both men and women, that for that period. It was a change of regime that the majority of the people, without knowing what was going to follow, welcomed. And as I mentioned earlier, Iranian women had done a lot of progress before the revolution. Honestly, there was nothing they could have not achieved. So they expected something more from the revolution, especially since they had taken part in it. But one of the first acts of the revolution was to suspend the family protection law that gave a lot of rights to women. And then it was the imposition of the hijab. And not only women came out around the university and marched around the university, that they walked to the office of the prime minister and they demonstrated there. And it is interesting to see that 43 years later, women, a different generation than mine, and probably younger than Roya too, are now demanding the same rights that were taken from them. So, you know, in those, if you look back, nothing basically has changed since the revolution started. On the contrary, women have had to fight at every step of the way. I gave you the example of age of marriage that was lowered to 9 for girls. It took 10 years for women activists to really work and raise the age of marriage to 13 and many other things, you know. So the women basically suffered legally, socially, and also in a way politically.
Yeah. And Roya, you've talked about how during those protests in 1979 that it had very strong support even from feminists from the Western world, people like Kate Millett. Is that same thing happening now? Are you seeing that, or is there something different happening now with these?
Well, it's interesting. Hala is absolutely correct that what we are seeing today is, in a way, a lot more the continuity of what began in 1979 than it is a disruption. So I think what really connects pre-revolutionary Iran to post-revolutionary Iran is this desire for women to become more equal within their own society. And that's, in some ways, one of the most important connecting fabric of this society, one of the most important themes that connects the two portions of this history that were so dramatically disrupted. Now, yes, I was 12 when these women took to the streets on March 8th of 1979, and I remember there were these rumors, and perhaps even I heard it in the media, that these women were bad women. They were prostitutes. They were out on the streets because they wanted they wanted to be to have the right to go to the discos, as if going to the disco was a terrible thing, and that somehow the notion was conveyed that they were corrupt or immoral, and their anxieties were all about, you know, having the right to, you know, wear bracelets. I remember there was this repetition of the idea that, you know, all their bracelets were dangling from their wrists when they threw their fists into the air. And it, all of these were meant to tell the younger generation of women and, you know, the broader public that somehow there was something wrong with these women, and these women were anti-revolution. They held the wrong or different values from the rest of the society that had carried out the revolution. I think what was very moving, especially in retrospect, was the presence of Western feminists, French and American, in the ranks of those women who were out on the streets on March 8th. And I think more than anything, it really conveyed the fundamental idea that certain rights, especially, you know, the idea of egalitarian values as far as the genders were concerned, were universal values. And the presence of these Western women in Iran, in Tehran, in those days, was really significant. There was nothing that could convey that idea better than the actual, you know, arm-in-arm march that Kate Millett and French feminists carried out in those days. But what happened in the aftermath was that that chain somehow was broken. We can discuss why, what the reasons were, but it was unfortunately broken. And I think for many, many years, Iranian women and their Western counterparts weren't really in dialogue with each other. And I think what has happened as a result of this last round of demonstrations is that somehow there seems to be a desire to reconnect again. And I think that's really significant. And in some ways, I think whatever this movement turns out to achieve, just the fact that this bond is being reestablished is really significant.
And Hele, I want to talk a little bit more about that bond and what it will take to sort of break that. And one point that you pointed out is just the misconceptions and misreporting in the West about what's happening there, even whether it was about which article of clothing it was about, that lack of understanding. Talk about the difficulty that folks in the West have in really understanding the culture and what is at the heart of these uprisings.
Well, I don't sense now that in the recent demonstrations and movement that the West is having a problem understanding it. It is very, it's crystal clear, you know, it started with a desire by women to be accepted equally in the society they live. But whether they want to continue living in this society, the current society, I doubt it, because really they are sick and tired of being told how to live, what to do, what to behave, not have access to employment despite they are educated, face economic hardship, be always pushed around. So it started as a women's movement, which was picked up in the West. I doubt it whether the women were not at the forefront of the recent protests, whether it would have resonated that much in the West. I don't know whether Roya agrees with me or not, but really it is the presence of women and the killing of Mahsa that triggered this movement. The first few days, you didn't have women from different walks of society or men from different walks of society joining the protesters. But later, after a couple of days, it is a protest movement that is encompassing everything we ever thought. And I feel they are going to have a lot of difficulties to calm this down, to suppress it, because I believe, you know, they will be back on the streets the next time something very minor even happens.
And Halle, was there in 1979 that sort of external support or support for different walks of life, including men, for these protests? And was there, by contrast, support among women for the hijab laws at that time? What did the landscape look like then?
Well, I remember that towards the last 2 months before the revolution, that women started wearing a scarf, and it irritated me a lot to see that, you know, women who never had even thought of observing the scarf, out of sheer respect to the demonstration, to what was going on, put the scarf on. I remember I went with a friend of mine to visit her mother, who was one of the pioneers of the Iranian women's movement. And the mother looked at her daughter and said, well, it took us a lot of life, blood, and work to get rid of the scarf. And now you people are voluntarily going to wear it. So, you know, in the beginning, there was this euphoria, but the euphoria died within maybe 2 or 3 months after the revolution for women. Having said that, there were a lot of religious women and even non-religious women who opted to wear the chador, the veil. But the generation, the second generation after that was born in during the revolution, couldn't stand the scarf, couldn't stand the veil, couldn't stand to be second-class citizens and pushed around and not have equal rights. So, I mean, the mentality, everything has changed. And, you know, they were talking to a woman. She said, well, so what if I get killed? You know, there is this sense that they have a cause now and they need to fight for the cause.
Yeah. Halle, you also experienced prison in Iran. Can you share that story with us?
Well, I had gone to, in 2007, 2006, December 2006, I went to visit my mother in Iran. And when I was leaving the country, actually it was New Year's Eve, I was stopped, and this was the beginning of an ordeal, the kind of country arrest for 8 months. And I spent almost three months in solitary confinement. It was a terrible experience. You know, I was blindfolded, was interrogated 8 to 9 hours a day, facing the wall, and covering myself in a veil. But as soon as I would go to my cell, I would remove the veil. And, you know, it was a very hard time. I was accused of being a spy, but they didn't have any evidence for that. So they tried everything, you know, to make me confess. I didn't have anything to confess. So I never got to meet any of my fellow prisoners in the women political ward because I was in solitary confinement. And Eileen, I was thinking last night that they have arrested a substantial number of women in the last in the last 10 days, maybe. But they are also, I read, they are in the same ward that I was kept. I don't know, the ward had only 4 or 5 rooms. How can they fit in so many women in that small ward? I feel very worried for them.
Yeah, Roya, what are your thoughts on that, just knowing Halle's experience and the number of arrests that are happening now?
Well, it's that is in addition to the fact that, you know, the riot police and other armed forces had encircled Sharif University last night and attacked the students on the grounds of the university, rounded up, shot at them. So all these are incredibly disconcerting and worrisome because all the sort of moral red lines that any society sets for itself, as in you don't shoot at people who are praying on a Friday. Well, yeah. They did that in Zahedan. You don't shoot at students at a university.
I'm going to pause you there. I'm going to pause you there. Halle Esfandiari is Director Emerita of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Roya will stay with us. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Later this week, we're going to talk about long COVID and how researchers are slowly finding that they are learning a lot about it by studying the research on a different disease, chronic fatigue syndrome. Have you or someone you know experienced long COVID? What has trying to understand your condition looked like for you? What have your doctors told you about it? Have they helped? Tell us your story by leaving a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, as the protests in Iran have spread and escalated, the natural question is, what's next? That's what many people inside and outside Iran are wondering. One person watching these protests from afar is Shireen Ebadi. Dr. Ebadi is Iran's first female judge before women were banned from the bench. She spent the next 30 years advocating for women's rights from inside Iran, and her work earned her the Nobel Peace Prize in 2003. But in 2009, she was forced to flee the country. We asked Dr. Ebadi to share her thoughts on these protests and where they might lead. She spoke to On Point via an interpreter.
The current unrest in Iran is in fact the beginning of a revolution in the country. Afterwards, nothing will be the same again. The people hope that this uprising will lead to the fall of the Islamic Republic. The recent protests were sparked by the killing of a young girl by the morality police. This was the last straw for the people whose 43 years of repressed anger caused by the misconduct of the regime has triggered a social explosion. For 43 years, the regime has ignored the people's demands and has continued to oppress them, in particular the women. Therefore, the women have been at the forefront of these protests.
Protests bring risk, as we've already seen. But Dr. Ebadi is optimistic about how they will end.
I am certain that the people will succeed and their victory will bring about the regime's downfall. The Iranian people seek a democratic and secular state because only under such a system, women will no longer be discriminated against. Men are also supporting this uprising because they know that the women's victory will lead to the establishment of democracy in Iran. Democracy will be achieved thanks to the strong Iranian women.
That was Dr. Shireen Ebadi. I'm joined now by Roya Hakakian, a writer and a poet. Her latest book is A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. She was born in Iran, but fled to the U.S. with her family in 1985, 6 years after the Islamic Revolution. Roya, I want to go back to a point that you were making when we ended the last segment about the protests happening at university, and I wanted you to finish that point and also talk about that is where the energy, a large part of this energy, is among young people in Iran.
Absolutely. Well, what I was trying to say before was that, you know, there are certain moral red lines that every society holds, such as you don't shoot at worshipers inside a church. You don't shoot at university students inside their buildings. All of these moral lines have been crossed in the past week. The regime shot at worshipers at a Friday prayer in Zahedan who had gone for Friday prayers. The regime last night carried out a very violent attack on the students of Sharif University in Tehran. This is a very different landscape from, say, 1978 and 1979, where, you know, the military of the former regime, of the Shah, knew and abided by these moral lines and didn't cross them. So it has been very ugly for the past 2 weeks. But what's also really incredibly staggering is the fact that people aren't running away. They don't seem to, I'm sure they're scared, but they keep coming back. And I think that's also one of the features of this round of demonstrations as opposed to previous ones. They seem to be readier to face the violence. They seem to be readier to really meet with the riot police. And that in part is because this is a young generation. You know, some of the kids who have died in the past few days are 15, 16, 17, 18-year-olds. They're teenagers. And I feel as though they have nothing to lose. And therefore, they take their lives into their hands and come out to the streets to meet the enemy.
Yeah. So what is the ultimate goal of these protests? We heard Dr. Ebadi say that it's to end the regime. Is this different? Is it different from in the past where there may have been efforts just to create more space for women, allow them to be on the bench, for example, but not the fall of the regime itself? Is the goal different this time?
Yes, it is. And it's very interesting because, you know, what we know to be the reform movement began in Iran with the rise of Mohammad Khatami to presidency in 1997. And, you know, for all these years, for nearly 25 years, we heard over and over again that there were reformists in Iran who were going to change things from within without resorting to a revolution. So things could improve in Iran by simple, you know, small steps incrementally. And they never achieved anything. I mean, the reformists were in power for as many years as the hardliners had been in power, and nothing simply changed. And, you know, a lot of experts kept blaming the United States for the reformists' inability to bring about any changes. But, you know, the reformists, again, were in power and still unable to effect any change. And I think once the public lost the hope that the reformists could not do anything. They recognize the fact that the system and the supreme leader and his leadership was so entrenched, was so immovable, that not even the reformists from within their own ranks could bring about any change. They now have given that up, given up the idea of reform, and they want a revolution. They are saying things they had never said before. Death to the dictator is something that you couldn't hear in 2009 during the Green Revolution or the Green Movement, when, you know, which is the previous mass demonstrations that Iran saw. You never thought that there would be a direct attack at the supreme leader, but there is now. People are defacing his images from the walls, from murals, pulling down his posters. There are high school kids who are taking off his images, his, you know, framed photos from their schools or classrooms. And that's also new. People in previous demonstrations would attack the things that they didn't like, say the hijab, but they would never reach for the supreme leader. But now they are.
And is this direct focus, this direct attack on the supreme leader, the reason why, as you said, all of the moral lines are being crossed?
Precisely. The moral lines have been crossed, and people very much feel that this is a brutal system that will spare no violence in order to send them back home. It will imprison them, kill them on the streets, do whatever it needs to do in order to simply, you know, bring about a quiet into the cities again. And not only that, in addition, it's also that they see that no matter how many times they came out and they were tried to kind of be in a dialogue with the regime, to say the few things, to articulate the few things that they wanted. Like, you know, for women for many, many years, it's been the mere right to enter soccer stadiums. You would think that, you know, the reformists could have delivered that, could have, you know, come to some kind of, negotiation, conclusion, or agreement on the idea of let women attend games. But they couldn't even deliver that. And I think having lost the hope of seeing even the smallest change, and also simultaneously having access to the internet, seeing what normal life is all about in other parts of the world, especially for teens, they really will not go home until they can have the hope of gaining some of those things that they call normal life. And that's really a very compelling feature of this movement. They want normal things, and they keep saying that. We want to be able to walk on the streets without fear. We want to hold hands. We want to kiss each other without feeling that we will be arrested. We want to dress. We want to dance. And this emphasis on the desire for a normal life is also something that, again, is incredibly compelling, but also very new about this round of demonstrations in Iran.
Well, one thing that is probably not new is that in response from outside of the country, in the West, just as our conversation began, Reuters reported that Germany, France, Denmark, Spain, Italy, and the Czech Republic have submitted 16 proposals for new European Union sanctions against Iran for its violent crackdown. The sanctions are targeted at the people and institutions primarily responsible for the clampdown on the nationwide protests. How important do you think things like this, sanctions from the West and other things, are to this movement? Or is it really about the women who are in the streets?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because as much as I respect Halle and admire her, and as much as I respect Shirin Ebadi and admire her, I disagree with them on one point. To say that these demonstrators will win is to be idealistic. I mean, sure, you know, history will always bend towards justice, as we know, but at what cost? And I think there is a way to lower the cost for Iranians, and that's international intervention. I think it's hugely essential to bring in the force of the international community in order to make sure that A, the demonstrators out on the streets know that they're being heard, and B, that the regime understands that it will be further alienated and deprived of resources if it continues to attack the protesters. We can't simply say they will win. It's wishful thinking. Of course they will win, but you know, in 50 years or in 5 years. And if we wanted to be faster and with less blood, we need to mobilize the international community to recognize what's happening in Iran as an extension of a universal struggle for democracy. I mean, at the end of the day, if Iran sees democracy, if Iran manages to become a more peaceful place, we will all benefit because the region will be at more peace. There will be less strife in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in other parts where Iran has its proxies. There will be, you know, a more equal Iranian society that is not anti-American will benefit not just the United States, but also Europe and other Western allies throughout the world. So I think it's very important for the international community to get involved, but also to see what's happening in Iran in some ways similar to the way we have seen Ukraine and its struggle for independence. It is a struggle for democracy, and that is good for all of us.
Well, you anticipated my next question because you made the point that those perceptions and misconceptions can be important. Talk a little bit about that, the difference in seeing this like Ukraine as opposed to seeing this like Syria or terming it as a civil war.
Yes. I mean, that's what's keeping me up at night. I think if we don't really frame what's going on in Iran in the proper way, we could easily, as an international community, wash our hands off of it and say, well, we don't understand what's going on out there because, you know, we Westerners, we Americans don't understand that region at all. I heard that from many politicians whom I met a week ago when I was at the Senate before the Senate Relations Committee, where I gave a testimony on what was happening in Iran. And, you know, senators, other politicians readily say, you know, how can we get involved? How can we do anything? Because we don't understand that region. We didn't understand Afghanistan. We don't understand Iraq. And look at Syria. We better not do anything because anytime we do anything, it just goes wrong. And first of all, I think that's a fundamentally wrong attitude to take about anything in life. But secondly, you know, Iran has been in the state of Cold War with America since 1974 can end with the success of these demonstrators out on the streets. This is, in some ways, a war that we as Americans have wanted to end for 43 years. And you know, rather than take our military, occupy Iran, we have an opportunity to allow Iranians themselves to succeed. And to miss that opportunity would be really to miss history once again.
Roya Hakakian is a writer and a poet. Her latest book is A Beginner's Guide to America for the Immigrant and the Curious. Roya, thank you so much for joining On Point.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.